Well, join us for one last blast here of summer storytelling on Wednesday. It's Current State's pop-up stories at Red Cedar Spirits in East Lansing. And I call it summer storytelling because our theme is the heat is on. The heat is on. If you've got a true first-person story that you'd like to share with us here Wednesday evening starting at 6 o'clock over on Merritt Road in East Lansing, we've still got room for storytellers. Visit our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. Should be a good time. We hope you can join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the top of our program here today on Current State, a painful chapter of Lansing history is being reopened this week. Donald Miller, whose deadly crimes gripped the Lansing area in 1977 and 1978, is scheduled to meet with state parole officials about his possible release from prison after 37 years behind bars. In July of 1979, Don Miller confessed to killing four young women, one of them an employee of WKAR-TV. Many critics have warned against parole, but Miller's former attorney, for one, says he's earned a chance at it. To discuss the parole hearing and other aspects of this story, we welcome two guests. Reporter Beth LeBlanc has been revisiting the Donald Miller story in the pages of the Lansing State Journal. Welcome, Beth.
Thanks, Mark.
We also welcome a Lansing area man who survived a brutal attack by Donald Miller. As a 13-year-old, Randy Gilbert encountered Miller immediately after Miller had attacked and raped Mr. Gilbert's sister at their Canal Road home in Delta Township. This was in August of 1978. The Gilbert survival was important in prosecuting Donald Miller. Randy Gilbert, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark.
Let's clarify what's scheduled to happen sometime this week. First of all, Beth, and I'll start with you. Help us understand the process a little bit better. Who will be deciding this and how?
Yeah, so this week, Don Miller is scheduled to meet with a member of the State Parole Board who will interview him for parole. After that, that member of the parole board will review the history of Don Miller's case, his interview with Miller, make a decision, and pass that on to a second member of the parole board. This is over a period of several weeks. Pass it on to a second member of the parole board who will review the case, review the notes from the first member's interview with Miller. If they agree, it is either denied or approved. If they disagree, a third member of the parole board will be brought in to kind of break that tie. If he's denied, I think that's the end of it, at least for now. If he's approved, it will go back to the two judges who sentenced Miller in Eaton and Chippewa counties. Since those judges are no longer around, it would be their successors who have to give the final stamp of approval on Miller's parole.
And has Miller gone before the parole board in the past? What's the history here, I guess, a little bit of any parole history?
Yeah. So he was convicted in 1979, pleaded guilty in 1979 to at least two murders. From 1989 to 1997, he met with the parole board about seven times, according to his parole records. And then he was convicted in 1998 of a prison violation, having a weapon inside of the prison. So at that time, 20 to 40 years were added to his sentence. So that's why there's that long length of time between the parole hearing in 1998 and the parole hearing now.
Mm-hmm. Randy Gilbert, you were a victim of Don Miller's. You and many others have said there's no way he should be granted parole. His former lawyer, though, Tom Bengston, on the other hand, told Beth that he deserves a chance after decades in prison. The phrase Mr. Bengston used was no assaultive behavior. He's earned parole. What do you think of that argument?
I think that's crazy. I mean, just the weapon charge that he has shows that he's not rehabilitated. This guy's crazy.
Yeah.
That floors me that he can think that way.
Tell us a little bit more about the weapons charge, because you mentioned he's committed a crime in Chippewa County while he was imprisoned. What do we know about that?
So while he was being held at the Kinross Correctional Facility in Chippewa County, prison officials said that they found a drawstring-type device underneath his bed in a footlocker during a shakedown in 1994. They said at the time that it appeared to be like a garrote or a strangling device. So they gave him a prison violation at that time. So he got like a misconduct ticket.
Mm-hmm.
I guess at the time they could have taken it to trial. They didn't until 1997. A community group actually in the Ingham-Eaton County area, they were looking at ways to basically try and keep Miller in prison as he was going through these several parole hearings. And they happened upon this violation from prison, and they realized that they could take him to court on it. So they took him to trial in Chippewa County on that count of having a weapon while in prison. He was convicted by a jury that could not know that he was a serial killer, so they couldn't know about his past killings. And even without knowing that on the merits of the case alone, they decided he was guilty of possessing a weapon in prison, and the judge sentenced him to 20 to 40 years.
Mm. I want to point out to our listeners that Randy Gilbert has the blessing of his sister, Lisa, to be doing this interview. And Randy, you've told me that if Lisa lived closer to Lansing and the circumstances were any different, even she would be willing to participate in this. I want our listeners to know that. Let's go back to the day you and your sister were both attacked by Don Miller. This was August 16th, 1978. Delta Township, Eaton County. Can you take a minute or so and just please walk us through what happened to you that day?
Yeah. What happened that day, I was around the house in the local area. I walk home and...
You were 13 years old,
13
right?
years yeah. old, middle yeah. of the summer. Go to the front of my house, notice there's a car in the driveway, not knowing whose car it was, didn't think much about it. I just walked into the house, and that's where I was confronted with Donald Miller. He came up to me and came around me, says, hi. I said, hi. He says...
That's bizarre.
Yeah.
He said, hi.
Yeah.
Stranger in your house.
Just looking
at
a stranger in my house, and he, a little guy, he didn't look like a threat to me, you know. And then he grabbed me and just says, I'm not going to hurt you. And then, things kind of changed. He said, where's your bedroom? I'm going to take you to your bedroom. You'll be safe there. Something to that fact. Mm. And with a knife to my throat, he took me to my bedroom and laid me down on the ground. And that's when he started slicing my throat.
Mm. You were stabbed 3 times.
Yes.
How badly were you hurt?
Physically or emotionally?
Well, both, I
yeah,
guess.
Yeah, pretty bad.
Yeah.
He slit my throat, stabbed me in the chest, punctured a lung. From what I've heard, they said he nearly scratched my heart, which could have been lethal. And then he also strangled me, and I was unconscious, left me for dead.
So you were stabbed 3 times, and you passed out after he strangled you, following the stab wounds, correct?
No. Actually, I was unconscious with the stab wound, then he stabbed me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You were unconscious, and then he stabbed you.
Yeah.
And this was all after he had attacked your sister? How did your sister's attack figure
this
into
this? This was after that, but at the time, I didn't even know he attacked my sister.
Okay.
I hadn't even seen my sister. I didn't know where my sister was.
And it turns out she was where? When you were being attacked.
She was in another room of the house.
Okay. And that had...
And then when he started attacking me, my sister was able to escape the house.
Mm-hmm.
She was not wearing any clothes and she was tied up, mm-hmm. but she ran out into the street, which mm-hmm. was a very busy street, Canal Road.
Yeah, yeah.
And some passerby stopped and helped her.
When were you able to understand... basically put all of this together and understand what had happened? Was it days later, weeks later? How long did it take you to sort all this out?
I'm still trying to sort it out, to be honest.
Yeah.
But it hit me probably, I was in and out of consciousness until I was in the ambulance. And that's when I heard my sister's voice for the first time asking, what happened to my brother? And I'm asking, well, what happened to my sister? Because I didn't know.
Oh.
And that's when they kind of explained what had happened on the way to the hospital.
Yeah.
And then from there on, I've never understood it.
How long were you hospitalized? How long did it take you to physically, let's just focus on the physical here. How long did it take you to physically recover from your wounds?
I believe I was in the hospital for Close to 2 weeks.
Close to 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. And what were those first weeks? I can't imagine what those first weeks and months were like going back to your home on Canal Road.
That was pretty horrific.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a whole nother story.
But you went back there to live. Is that right?
I didn't want to, but I was
kind
of forced to.
It was your home.
As a 13-year-old boy, you don't really have those choices.
Yeah.
Randy, I know, throughout this case, I mean, you're in your sister's case. It was kind of the one that unraveled what Don Miller had been doing. It kind of stopped him. It led to his eventual conviction. It later led to those guilty pleas in the murder of those four other women. And now, so you guys kind of had to go through that. And now it kind of seems like you guys are the ones whose testimony, again, may keep Don Miller in prison. I guess, what is it like to have to relive this again?
I've been asked that question 1,000 times, and I still can't find the answer. It's tougher now, I think. Before, you know, I felt comfortable that he was in jail. Mm-hmm. You know, I could try to live my life as I could, but knowing that he can get out now is just life-changing. I mean, I don't know how to put it into words, even after being asked so many times, but it's, I got to figure out how I'm going to deal with it. I mean, I know I put this guy in jail, and I'm pretty sure he's mad at me about it. He was mad at Martha Sue Young for denying him. And look what he did to her. So I've got to live that way, feeling that he's mad, and probably will be coming after me.
We're talking with Randy Gilbert. In 1978, Randy Gilbert was attacked by Donald Miller, and it was Randy's survival and his sister's survival after being attacked by Don Miller that was important in prosecuting Donald Miller and putting him behind bars for 37 years. This week, at some point, Donald Miller is scheduled to meet with parole officials. He's currently serving time at the Cotton Correctional Facility in Jackson. Beth LeBlanc of the Lansing State Journal has been covering the parole hearing for the Lansing State Journal. She joins me as well. How has your sister dealt with this over the years? And have you, I'm curious what the relationships have been like with you and your sister having gone through being attacked by this guy.
Well, my sister's far, far away. I think she put herself far, far away from this on purpose. She and I have never really discussed it with each other.
Really?
To each other. Hmm. It's pretty hard to face her and to talk about it, knowing that she gotten hurt, and I think she feels the same way about me. Hmm. We just... we're there for each other. We'll do anything for each other. We know that about each other. We love each other and we support each other. Mm-hmm. But as far as talking about it, it doesn't happen.
Even in those weeks and months after the attack, you were a young guy. I can understand why maybe it was just impossible to talk about. But and it's been that way ever since, basically, you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Randy, can you tell us a little bit about the support system that you had back then, or even now, as Miller approaches another parole hearing? I know a lot of people are kind of gathering to oppose this parole. You're among that group. Can you tell me a little bit about who is providing you support at this time?
Yeah, at this time, I'm getting a lot of support from my attorney, Mike Hocking, who was also the prosecuting attorney that first put Donald Miller away for us. I also have great support from Eaton County prosecuting attorney Doug Lloyd. Very, very helpful man there. And Ingham County prosecutor Gretchen Whitmer. She's been very supportive. Peter Haupt, who was former Ingham County prosecuting attorney and judge. He's been a lot of help and very supportive as well. And Frank Ashberg, he's an MD. I think he's associated here with MSU.
He's been on this program.
Yeah. Wonderful man.
Yeah.
Very, very supportive. And there's a bunch of others as well that I'm sorry if I forget their names at the moment. But that group in general have really come up for us today and has been very helpful.
You've got a lot of credible voices here who are speaking very vigorously against parole. Can you take it, that must provide some degree of reassurance for you.
It does. It makes me feel safe, you know, especially when I'm in the room with them and we're all talking. I also wanted to mention, too, that we got a letter from Attorney General Bill Schuette. That was huge. Yeah. You know, personally, that was huge for me. It showed me that people are out there listening. People are helping.
And I know we've talked before, Randy, about the fact that it is difficult to speak out on this at this point. It is difficult to go before the parole board. I guess, what is making you speak out about this and come forward and share your story with other people? What do you hope to accomplish with that?
Well, I hope to get other people to realize what's going on here, get the general public aware of who Donald Miller is, what Donald Miller has done. You know, I ask your listeners to Google this guy and read about him. It's, like I said earlier, it's an ugly read, but the community needs to know that he is going to get out. He is going to be released at some point sooner than we hope. And I think it's important that the community knows what's going to be released in their area and be aware of what he's done and hopefully reach somebody that can help change something. I don't know, to keep him in or, yeah. You know, but I think the public really needs to be aware.
Well, the best place to do that, I would argue, is at the Lansing State Journal website here, just to give Beth a plug, because you've done a really strong job of just retelling the whole story. I was here for that. This was years before you were born, Beth, but a lot of people are learning about this for the very first time here just in recent days. Your sister told Beth for her stories that she forgives Don Miller, but that he is also beyond rehabilitation and should not be granted parole. Do you forgive Don Miller?
No.
Like your sister?
No. Yeah. That's, you know, my sister's, that's fine for her, but I agree with her on everything but that.
Tell us a little bit more about your important connections here with Eaton County. I know Doug Lloyd and Mike Hocking. Describe the relationships you have with those guys. How are you working with them exactly?
Well, Mike, as I mentioned before, Mike Hocking, he was the prosecuting attorney at the time. He has always been there from that day till now. He's always offered support, any help that I've ever wanted, even on a personal level, you know. He's always been there for me and my sister. Doug Lloyd, I believe Doug is an angel sent down from the late Honorable Jeff Sauter. He's a wonderful man. Just getting to know him recently. And he's done a lot of things for me. And very supportive, and it helps a lot. Both of them just, like I mentioned before, they both make me feel really safe, and I don't get much of that.
Yeah. Well, we will be watching what happens in the interaction with Donald Miller and state parole officials. For now, I want to thank both of our guests. Beth LeBlanc has been revisiting the Donald Miller story in the Lansing State Journal. We also want to offer a special thanks to Randy Gilbert. As a 13-year-old, Randy encountered Don Miller immediately after Miller had attacked and raped Mr. Gilbert's sister at their Canal Road home in Delta Township, August 16th, 1978. Thank you so much for being with us today. Good luck to you. Coming up on Current State, the Capital Area Transportation Authority's bus rapid transit plan is facing opposition from some Meridian Township businesses. Now the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce has weighed in. We'll talk with Chamber President Tim Damon and the chairman of the Chamber's board, Joe Ford, about their opposition. That's on the way. Well, lovers of independent and unique films have a new reason to be excited. The Flint Institute of Arts is launching its Friends of Modern Art film series. 9 months of international, independent, and classic fare. That begins in early September. Here to tell us more about it and give us a preview of some of the films is Associate Curator of Film at the Flint Institute of Art, Arts, Ed Bradley. Ed, welcome to Current State.
Good morning.
Sounds like you have a fun job.
It is a fun job.
Yeah.
I get to decide what kind of movies we bring into town and get the word out to people to see them, like in forums like this, and host movies and write about them in program notes. So you can immerse yourself for 9 months or so and then have a summer break.
What kind of films do you typically seek out for the series?
Well, the series has been going on for 20, 25 years. I've been here where it's grown significantly the last 7 or 8. And we try to mix thematically scripted and non-scripted films, say, fiction versus documentaries, plus foreign films versus independent American films, throw in a few classic movies. Our core series is sponsored by our auxiliary, the Friends of Modern Art, which is Friday and Saturday nights and Sunday afternoons, but we do other kinds of series too. And we do partnerships with local organizations, themed festivals on other topics as well, not just the core series. So it is a lot of fun, but it's a challenge, I think, in finding the right balance, especially for the audience that we have.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk about the 5 September-October films here All that right. you've selected to kick off the festival. One is called The Lobster. What's this about?
Well, The Lobster is a very interesting mix. It's a romantic comedy, but it's also kind of a science fiction movie. It takes place in one of those futuristic societies where things have changed a great deal for perhaps not for the good. And in this society, Colin Farrell plays a guy who unattaches from his wife and must find a new mate within 45 days, or per the rules of the society, he gets turned into an animal like anyone else who is single. And it's really a commentary on modern relationships, the pressure that society puts on people to find someone. So is it better to be that way or to be lonely?
A lot of big names in this film. You heard Colin Farrell, Rachel Weisz, John C. Reilly. We're going to hear a clip from the trailer where an employee at the hotel is checking in the guy played by Colin Farrell.
Have you ever been on your own before?
No, never.
Your last relationship lasted how many years?
12.
Sexual preference?
Women.
Any children?
No.
And the dog?
This is my brother. He was here a couple of years ago, but he didn't make it.
Okay. Why in the end, why'd you choose this film?
Well, it's interesting because when we're programming for a series like this, where we have kind of off-the-beaten-track movies and not your typical franchise movies, it's very hard to find art house kind of comedies. And this is kind of on the border between that. It's not exactly an art film, but not exactly a mainstream film either. And so we're looking for movies just kind of like this that are thoughtful and funny.
Right. Another film on the list, I Saw the Light. This is a Hank Williams biopic starring Tom Hiddleston, who's British, but he sings all the songs in the movie. Let's hear a clip.
Let's give a rousing welcome to Mr. Hank Williams. All right, boys, let it roll.
Hey, good looking.
When he first came to see me, he played some songs he'd written, and I offered him a contract right then and there.
Cooking something up with me.
And what about this one made you choose it?
Well, we're doing it. This is part of a kind of an adjunct series we were having about spotlighting the lives of famous American music people. For example, in October, we have a movie, Miles Ahead, about Miles Davis. Mm. So this is our September pick. And, you know, Hiddleston is a British actor, as you said. He's most famous for playing Thor in the Avengers movies and for being Taylor Swift's current boyfriend, but he does a great job in this movie at echoing, you know, the soulfulness of Hank Williams, who, of course, is kind of a tragic figure in music.
What a diverse couple of roles, from Thor to Hank Williams.
Yeah.
That is quite an oeuvre. Another film in the series, The Man Who Knew Infinity. Give us a little bit of background on this.
Well, it's based on a true story about a pioneer Indian mathematician and the English professor, professor who's English, who mentored him. A couple names are familiar: Dev Patel, who was the male lead in Slumdog Millionaire, the Oscar-winning film, and of course Jeremy Irons, who's a very well-known actor, are the two stars of this movie. And it's more than just kind of a formula biopic. I think it's a movie thing people will find a lot of humanity in, as well as the scientific aspect of it.
And we've got a clip from the trailer here. Again, the voices of Dev Patel and Jeremy Irons.
You wanted to know how I get my ideas? God speaks to me.
There are no proofs.
We're just supposed to take him at his word?
No, you're to take him at mine.
And there are two more that we want to briefly touch on. One is called Sing Street. This one looks really fun. Tell us about it.
Yeah, Sing Street is from the director of Once, the Irish movie Once, you might remember from a few years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Won an Oscar for Best Picture. And this is another music-oriented film about a young man in 1980s at Dublin who essentially tries to win a girl by starting a rock band. And that's essentially what the plot is, but it's a lot of fun, a lot of humanity in it. I think people will really enjoy that as well. We're showing that in mid-September.
And the last one is Maggie's Plan. This one has a couple of big names, Julianne Moore and Christian Slater. What's this one about?
Well, Maggie's Plan is our season opener. It's September 9th is our first showing of that. Greta Gerwig plays a young woman who wants a family, and so she marries, she kind of steals Ethan Hawke away from his wife, played by Julianne Moore. They get married, have a child, but she realizes over time that perhaps her husband is probably best off with his former wife. So her plan is to get them back together, which is not the typical kind of thing we see in romantic comedies, but I think it's a movie people will find very interesting. And it's got a great cast, too.
You mentioned the series has been going on for about 25 years, but I gather that you feel it's gotten stronger these past six seasons. Why the improvement here recently?
Well, a couple different reasons for that. I think we've been getting the word out better at the museum about the series. We have new digital projection equipment, kind of to keep up with the Joneses in terms of getting new films. But also, I think in Flint, there is a real hunger. People think of Flint as a working class city, which of course it obviously is, but there is a strong audience there for our, you know, more quote unquote artistic kinds of movies, not just the typical Hollywood superhero franchise movies. And so we've done very well audience-wise. Our audience has been way up the past 5 or 6 years.
We want to thank Ed Bradley, who is the Associate Curator of Film at the Flint Institute of Arts. Their upcoming movie season kicks off September 9th with 5 or 6 films here, and we've spent a little bit of time with each one of them. Ed, have a great season. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on Current State, those of us of a certain age remember the old 1970s TV commercial with the tagline, "It's not nice to fool Mother Nature." Well, storyteller Mark Sunderman learned that firsthand on a camping trip to Montana. He'll share his story about the call of the wild. It's a pop-up story on the way on Current State. Current State, 3 times every weekday here on WKAR, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM, and every day at noon on AM 870. We're always at WKAR.org. Current State's been covering the Capital Area Transportation Authority's plan to build a bus rapid transit system, or BRT, between downtown Lansing out to Meridian Township. CATA has secured millions of dollars in grants to pay for the project, over $100 million, which would devote special lanes along Michigan Avenue and Grand River Avenue for buses. Opposition has been voiced along the route, and especially in Meridian Township. Now the plan has a newer foe. Last week, the Greater Lansing Chamber of Commerce announced that it opposes the BRT. Joining us to discuss this latest development, Chamber President Tim Damon. Tim, welcome back.
Good morning, Mark.
And Joe Ford of NetVantage Marketing. Joe is the chairman of the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors. Joe, welcome to Current State.
Thanks, Mark.
Let's parse the statement that your group put out last week opposing the BRT. It states, among other things, the decision not to support the BRT system comes following months of research on the part of LRCC, including trips to other communities that have invested in similar systems. Where'd you go to look over these systems, Tim, and what were the negatives that you found in those towns?
Well, sure. Well, thank you. So for us, it really started a little bit over a year ago when we took a group to Cleveland. So I think there was a delegation of probably, I think, around 35, 36 folks, community and business leaders from Lansing area here that went to Cleveland and spent the day. And you know, for us, it was an opportunity, I think, to kind of get your arms around what is bus rapid transit and how does it look and feel and whatnot. And so I think seeing it in Cleveland certainly helped put everything into perspective. And upon the return from there, the Chamber, along with Michigan State University, while others in the community would not go to Grand Rapids, us and Michigan State University, and I also think the City of East Lansing, you know, went over to take a look at the Grand Rapids bus rapid transit and how they had implemented as well. And two vastly different implementations, you know, from center lane infrastructure in Cleveland to the curbside load dedicated lanes during certain peak rush hours in the morning and evening in Grand Rapids. And but certainly both along the same type of economic sectors, and that being higher ed and healthcare, both in Cleveland and in Grand Rapids. And then I think subsequently, you know, coming back from there, our policy committee and continuing through the due diligence had several meetings, including one with a group of members throughout the region here, as well as CATA leadership came in and met with our policy committee members as well back in the middle part of July.
Joe, did you go to Cleveland?
I did not, Mark.
Okay.
No, I was not on either of those trips.
You were on these trips,
yes.
Though. Are those systems appropriate for Cleveland and Grand Rapids in ways that they're not appropriate for Lansing?
Well, I think that the one thing you take away from there is that each community, as we all know, is going to be uniquely different. And how you implement public transportation or transportation systems like a BRT are going to continue to be unique to those communities. In Cleveland, Euclid Avenue, the avenue where the BRT runs is vastly, vastly different than the Michigan Avenue corridor. It's, you know, the infrastructure is much wider. The center lane infrastructure worked there. There was access on parallel streets to get to where folks were going. So the whole center lane, turn lane aspect in Cleveland was negated by that. And we heard that from both the business communities we talked to, the economic developers that we talked to, representatives from the transportation authority as well in Cleveland, and how that was implemented. And then I think when you look at Grand Rapids, they chose to go a different approach because, again, it fit within, you know, within their community and how they were implementing the BRT into into Grand Rapids. Mm.
Joe, what about CATA's presentation? They made a presentation. Apparently, it did not convince you. What did you take from that presentation?
Well, they were gracious enough to come in July and talk to our policy committee, Mark, and they did a good job of laying everything out in terms of the plan of showing the full map of what they proposed, what's existing now versus what they want to put into place. We had some very pointed questions at the end of that frankly, we didn't get good answers to at the end of it. And we had a good dialogue with their leadership, but it really came down to a number of things that didn't get satisfied to what we want as we talked to our members and their concerns. And again, this doesn't have to do so much with those in Meridian Township. I think that's almost his own sphere because of some of the concerns they've had. We've obviously got members in Meridian Township, but this was more from general members of the business community, both from large enterprise corporations down to small businesses that were voicing their concerns to us about this plan that was laid out. Some real, we talked about contingency plans. So if Meridian Township is going to oppose this, what is the contingency plan of perhaps a capital to campus route, which I think we're all in favor of? And also, too, I would say that, Mark, It does fly in the face of convention that us as a chamber, a regional chamber, that has done so many things on the regionalism front, would oppose this. I understand that there could be, you could pick up that headline and scratch your head when you see that, but we just didn't like how that plan was in place. So to come back to their meeting, you know, there were very specific questions we had about some of the infrastructure, curbside loading versus center lane, the traffic concerns of what's there now. We all know it's congested now. They seem to think this it would actually improve it. One of the main issues, though, is the revenue projections. And when we want to know and see, when you're building something like this and you're putting such a large-scale infrastructure change into place that's going to cost $134 million down, obviously, if they found some savings from the original plan of $195. The grants are not revenue. Grants are grants. And at the end of the day, we're all paying for those in one way, shape, or form. A federal or state grant still, at the end of the day, comes out of our pocket. That's fine. And there's obviously an important piece of the puzzle for those. That's not revenue. And so long-term funding was a concern. And if we haven't solved that problem, I don't think as an organization that has a business mindset where you have profit, loss, revenue, expense, you can't support it in that current plan without a more clear forecast of what the revenue will be. What is the ridership revenue on Route 1 now, and how will that be impacted moving forward? What is their anticipation of increased ridership due to the efficiency of the time going down from 9 minutes to 6 minutes in the savings? What's the revenue gain? Because once it's built, it has to be maintained.
Do you question that 1.7 million ridership? I know some critics have.
I do not. I don't know enough about that to say that's a question. I know it's hard to get information about some of that information from some of those specifics and details from CATA. That's probably another story. But I wanted to see a very concise chart in 19, if the shovel's hitting the ground like they say it was supposed to in 17, 18, even though we've got this debate now of about 30% funded, which seems to have surfaced here lately, in its format, you know, what
30% designed, right. I think is what
Excuse
you're meant to
me.
Say.
Yeah, yeah, which is, you know, and we could talk about that. But, you know, what does that revenue forecast look like when we're at full, you know, when we're, now we've got our efficiencies in place. And I'm not concerned about, you know, the efficiency of the ridership. And I think we all agree that we want a comprehensive regional transportation plan for the area. And this would be huge because it's coming right down our main corridor. But again, it came down to dollars and cents. And then the other issue, too, is there just seems to be a lack of communication throughout this whole process. And I think everybody in the community would kind of shake their head, yes, we would agree with that. CATA would probably even acknowledge that. And hey, in their defense, this is a very large undertaking. I know this has been quite the challenge to try to get this across. But we brought up the concern of if this can't go all the way from Okemos or the Meridian Mall to the Capitol, okay, what's the contingency plan? Could we still get the proper funding from the federal grant process in place to just fund a Capitol Campus project, which I think we all would agree could be a nice option. We constantly talk about opening the doors from students to come to downtown Lansing, breaking that barrier of the 127 bridge down that we always talk about, you know, making that. And the answers we got in that setting, they weren't sufficient. The answer we got was the plan is the plan. Okay, so there isn't a contingency plan in place.
It's so interesting to try to interpret that here, too. And we intend to get more guests from CATA on the program
Sure.
to try to understand this. But because one of their ongoing claims is the project is only 30% designed. So they hear criticism, they hear recommendations, and they say there's time to work these into the design. Mm-hmm. Are you skeptical about that, Tim Damon? Or I mean, 30%? Means 70% is still fluid.
Sure. Well, you know, this 30% is something, as Joe referenced, I think is something that's really has come up after some of our meetings with CATA. That was certainly not our understanding or impression as we met with them earlier this year when they were talking about, you know, final approvals coming into play this fall with shovels in the ground in 2017. So to me, that's not a project that's 30% engineered. And even as we were going through our policy committee meeting, you know, with the CATA leadership, that issue was never as much being at the forefront as it has been since we've come out with our, you know, with our position here. So, so I think we are a little skeptical on it being 30% engineered and the changes and having something 30% engineered, but we're also told 100% funded is not logical, Mark. So I think you've got to somehow in there, you've got to kind of question that. And again, I think it gets back to that communication and making sure that everything is being, everyone's being very transparent here. And I don't know that there's been a lot of transparency in this process.
Tim Damon and Joe Ford of the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce join us. The chambers come out in opposition to CATA's bus rapid transit proposal for new service between the state capitol and the Meridian Mall. You alluded to the process here, and there are recurring complaints of CATA's handling of the process. They haven't answered our questions. They dismissed my question. I've heard that a few times. This has created some resistance and some degree of resentment, I think.
Well, you know, nobody likes to create an environment where there's all of a sudden there's distrust and all of a sudden everybody's on edge and there's tension. As a region, nothing's going to get done if we go in that way. We can all agree to that. We all want the same thing. You know, first and foremost, our absolute champion corridor in this region, in the Tri-County region, is that real estate from Michigan Avenue to Michigan State. That should be a shining beacon of what our region stands for. Right now, it's crumbling. You could go down and fill a whole dump truck just full of little pebbles from the pavement coming up. There'll actually be a viewpoint piece in the Lansing State Journal tomorrow, penned by me, that details that. It's a small snippet of all what needs to be done, and it has to run concurrently to what this project is. And I think in CATA's defense, they're saying, "Hey, look, part of this, there are some plans in place by the city to work on that infrastructure, which is sorely needed." Our concern now is this has all come up. Again, as business people, as a business owner myself that has a business two blocks off this corridor in East Lansing, and as many, many other small businesses and large businesses have, from Accident Fund to Sparrow down to, the car dealership there, the old Bud Coates car dealership, we all have a vested stake in this. And I don't think it does us any good to create vigor and distrust, but I think that we need to come back together and decide, okay, if we're going to do a BRT, fine. How does that play into fixing Michigan Ave now? If not, what's the next alternative, and how far is this going to get pushed back? Because we have to get something in place by the end of 17-18, because that roadway, as we all know, is just getting pounded, and we've got a lot of important organizations on it.
You've both talked about the truncated line, the Lansing to East Lansing, downtown Lansing to campus. What if CATA came back and put that on the table? Are you expecting something like that? What are you expecting CATA to come back to the table with here?
Hard to predict what they'll do, Mark. They'll have to probably come back with that response. But if they came back with that, I think everybody, including Michigan State, who's a large player in this, and both municipalities involved, would take a long look at that. Again, that's a good option. That shows a contingency plan. That's good.
You'd revisit your opposition if they came back to the table with that, Tim?
Let me finish that statement. As long as we can see viable funding options beyond the grant process to make sure it was maintained properly, I think that that's something that would be considered.
And I think, too, to Joe's point on the infrastructure, is I look at this in a bigger picture and say, you know what, perhaps it's not a BRT that we need on there, but it's something that's connecting campus to capital that goes along with what Joe's saying and how we rebuild out this infrastructure here. And this is what Grand Rapids did. I mean, when they implemented this, and their investment kind of came into technologies and wireless and new bus stops that were kind of connected electronically. So I think there's ways to do this without the major infrastructure investment of center lane down the corridor. I will tell you something, that within our membership, that is the number one issue. So we will not revisit that. That is the number one issue, is the center lane infrastructure down the middle of Michigan Avenue and taking the lanes out of there. So that's something that we're going to have to figure out how, in this 70% that's non-engineered, as we're being told, then we better kind of factor that into that 70%.
Our guests have been Tim Damon and Joe Ford of the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce. The chambers come out in opposition to CATA's bus rapid transit proposal for new service from the state capitol building to the Meridian Mall. Joe, Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
Well, it's It's time for another pop-up story from our last event at Valley Court Park, East Lansing, where the theme was The Call to the Wild. Storyteller Mark Sunderman shared about a time he and his family went on a trip and things didn't go so well. And a warning, the story does get a little graphic.
I blame Joe Pesci for the situation I found myself in standing on the banks of the Blackfoot River in Montana. If you don't know where Montana is, look it up in the dictionary under nature. It's a great picture. Because I was staring up at this ravine that I had to get up, and I looked down at my lifeless right foot and wondered, how in the world am I ever getting out of here? Now, it was the summer of 1997, and that summer there was a particular commercial that came out, and it was a Lexus commercial, and Joe Pesci was the voice of the Brooklyn Bridge. And the earworm that had migrated into my brain was him saying, Joe Pesci, you want a piece of me? Huh? And that's what I said to the Blackfoot River earlier that morning as I was standing knee-deep and my father was getting our rafts together for the two-hour drift that we were going to do. I was saying to the river, you want a piece of me, huh? And I smacked it. My dad says, son, that's not a very good idea. Why? You're upsetting the river spirits, I can tell. It's not cool. River spirits, you want a piece of me? I smacked it again. He decided that he didn't want to have any business with the river spirit guy messing things up. So he and his wife got in the one raft, and my brother-in-law and my sister and I got in the other raft, and we started our two-hour drift. Now, you can't be in Montana in the Blackfoot River without a fly rod, which my father and I both had. And about 40 minutes in, we find this perfect spot. There are two flat-top rocks just a few inches from the bank. There's all these deep eddies and pools filled with monster trout. My father says, should we? And I said, yes. We pulled over. And as we were walking up or back downstream to the two rocks, I said, Dad, you take this one and I'll take that one. And as I was stepping from the riverbank onto the rock, I remember saying, yo, trout, you want a piece of me? And that's when I started to fall backwards. My Teva sandal had pushed that moss away from there and had created a perfect suction. There was 200-plus pounds of dude falling down and backwards, and that leg wasn't going to move. And I also remembered that there were several large rocks behind me, so I turned very quickly to the left as I fell backwards, and I felt something smack, and I rolled into the water. It wasn't too deep. That was okay. But I knew something was seriously, seriously wrong with my leg. And I pulled my leg out of the river, and all I saw was my skin stretched over the bottom part of my leg. There's no foot. Where's my foot? I turned my leg like this, and there it was. I had broken my fibula. Now, there are probably 100 people in this world that I'd rather have an emergency. My dad is not one of them. And the look of panic on his face at that moment in time reminded me of that situation. But two angels descended from heaven and put hands on his shoulders. And this look of calm overcame him. And he took that knotted calf of mine with all the muscles all pulled over in the wrong direction very gently. And he just touched my foot. And it went right back into place. And I remember my brother-in-law saying, oh, yes, everything's going to be okay now. Meanwhile, my sister had done the greatest Mike Phelps impersonation across the Blackfoot River and scurried up that ravine and landed on a car. My brother's dying. Please help us. So there I was, father on one side, brother-in-law on the other. 2.5 hours later, we made it out of that ravine, and I had to step on that busted leg 3 different times. And I will tell you, it's like stepping in lava. Now, it's Joe Pesci's fault, but there are a few other things that I learned as a result of the 6 months of rehabilitation and 2 surgeries later. 1, physical therapists make you do really funny exercises that move muscles you never even knew existed. 2, the accessibility options for somebody who is got some mobility issues in 1997 were not very good and still are not today. And the third thing that I learned as a result of my call of the wild was don't ever dare the river to take you out because she will not hesitate to do so. Thank you.
Remember, our next pop-up stories event is this Wednesday, the 31st, 6 p.m. Join us at Red Cedar Spirits, Merritt Road, East Lansing. The theme is The Heat Is On. There is limited space at the venue, so be sure to reserve a spot. You can find the link to reserve your spot on our Facebook event page, Pop-Up Stories, The Heat Is On. We hope to see you there. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, rescuing a victim of human trafficking is always an emergency, but experts say one of the hardest places to spot those victims is in a hospital emergency room. A healthcare organization in Genesee County will use a state grant to find better ways of identifying and treating human trafficking victims. We'll talk with two guests affiliated with the Genesis Health Foundation. And the Airmen of Note is a U.S. Air Force jazz ensemble that's performed all over the world. The Airmen perform next Saturday in Albion. They are always hot. What a group of performers. Current State's Jamie Paisley previews that performance. We hope you can join us tomorrow here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. It's Current State on WKAR.